This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Jubilation is still one of the most important threads of the news today from Iraq, but so are chaos, looting, arson, assassination, and continued combat. In Najaf, in central Iraq, a crowd attacked and killed two Shiite Muslim clerics inside a famous mosque. In central Baghdad, a suicide bomber struck a checkpoint manned by U.S. Marines, and elsewhere in the city, looters broke into government offices and the mansions of some of Iraq's former leaders. There was sporadic fighting, some of it quite heavy, between U.S. troops and fighters loyal to Saddam Hussein. The situation remains confused and dangerous as U.S. forces attempt to secure Baghdad and other parts of the country. This hour, we'll bring you the latest from the Iraqi capital and look at the history of this ancient city, and we'll also get reactions to the fall of Baghdad, including yours. If you want to phone in and tell us how you felt about the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime in Baghdad, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Baghdad is Larry Kaplow, a reporter for Cox Newspapers. And Larry, it's always late when we talk to you. It's always good of you to stay up to speak with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
What can you tell us about this suicide bombing in central Baghdad?
On the checkpoint in the Saddam City neighborhood of Baghdad, and Saddam City is a famous slum, basically, that's on the northeast side of Baghdad, and it's called a neighborhood, but it has probably about 2 million people in it, and they're almost all Shia Muslims, and very oppressed and deprived people. The Marines say that a man walked up to the checkpoint and blew himself up, injuring 4 Marines, is what they say at this point. They didn't have figures about whether any other Iraqis may have been injured, and of course the bomber died. And what it did was it just made the Marines extremely excited and nervous, not only there, but even at our hotel, which they are basically have a large perimeter set up on. I saw one standing telling some others the news and pointing at them very excitedly saying, do not let any civilians get near you. Any Arab, and he pointed to an Arab who was walking through the door, must be checked. And at that point, they peeled off the hotel and wouldn't even let journalists in for a while. So there's a very high state of anxiety among them.
Well, I know you were also out this morning walking around the city talking to people. What did you see and what did people tell you?
Well, what you see are people loading computers onto donkey carts and air conditioning units onto lorries that they've had pulled up. And other people I saw a man and a woman carrying a large metal cabinet that they'd obviously taken out of some government office, barely being able to get it down the street. So they're stealing more than they can carry, basically, government buildings. Now, that they don't seem yet to have turned to houses or stores. It's government buildings. This was a socialist country, so there are a lot of those around, and offices. And there have been a couple of embassies, and the ICRC says that even some hospitals have basically had people come in and just take things from them. In one case, they had a truck and some tools and started stealing air conditioning units from the hospital. When you ask them why they're doing it, they say it's not stealing. The government treated them badly for a long time. The government stole their money, and now they're getting something back.
ICRC, you mentioned, of course, the International Committee of the Red Cross. Are American troops, we're told from headquarters back here that American troops have been issued orders to do what they can to stop the looting. Is there any sign of that yet on the streets?
Well, maybe the operative phrase is what they can. They have, at some government posts, the American Army or Marines have sealed them off and basically set up perimeters and look like they're going to use those buildings. One that comes to mind is the Oil Ministry, which is 2 fairly tall buildings, maybe about 15 stories each here, that are very modern, and there are now American vehicles and Jeeps and Humvees around that. But in most cases, it's just not a high priority. And I'll also point out that most of the time, the looting is not violent. It's just people going into buildings that, in many cases, have already been bombed and stealing everything they can get. I went to the Olympics office, which was a province of Ode Hossein, and people were walking out with bags full of soccer balls and athletic shoes and trophies and anything they could find there.
Sounds a little bit more useful than a filing cabinet, anyway. What's the humanitarian situation in Iraq for food, water, electricity, medical care?
In Baghdad, there's still no clean electricity, and I think that makes things more dangerous because you go out now at night and there are no street lights, and you just sort of see these figures on the corner, and they're Marines trying to figure out who you are, and you're trying to figure out who they are. And now have not gotten many casualties in the last 2 days. And it sounds like the ICR, the Red Cross, has had trouble getting to them, but they seem to have plans to try to get to some of them tomorrow and deliver some more supplies. So that seems to have leveled off. There was fighting in a couple areas of town today, and there were a lot of wounded, I'm told, and that they would have shown up at the hospitals, but certainly not like it was 3 days ago.
Back here also, we heard a lot about messages by President Bush and Prime Minister Blair of Britain that were broadcast today on Iraqi television channels. Was anybody able to see them? Obviously few in Baghdad if there was no electricity.
I was not able to, and I haven't been able to find anyone who was able to. People do have generators, and in some neighborhoods they'll get a generator and share it among three or four houses. So it would be possible for a small percentage of people to have seen it in Baghdad. And then outside of Baghdad, they may have a lot more.
Well, Larry Kaplow, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Larry Kaplow is a reporter for Cox Newspapers, and he spoke with us from Baghdad. And now we want to talk about the situation in the city of Najaf. In a sign of a precarious peace today, a Shiite cleric was hacked to death at one of Shiite Islam's holiest shrines. He was attending a meeting that was called to discuss reconciliation. Joining us now from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Hassan Nehmeh, director of the Iraq Research and Documentation Project at Harvard University. Good of you to join us.
Yeah, thank you.
First of all, tell us about the one of the men who was killed, the best-known one, this man, Abdul Majid al-Khoei.
Yes, Abdul Majid al-Khoei was the son of the late Grand Ayatollah Abul Qasim al-Khoei. Abul Qasim al-Khoei in his time was the most prominent religious authority for Shia Muslims worldwide, and he reportedly was executed by the Saddam regime. His son Abdul Majid was an Iraqi exile resident of London. He was very active in the Khoei Benevolent Foundation, which is a worldwide charitable institution. He was a voice of moderation and reconciliation in Islamic circles, respected by Sunni Muslims as well as by Shia Muslims. He called on Quranic principles to advocate a compatibility between Islamic values and democracy and human rights. He was a frequent participant in public debates on Al Jazeera and on other Arabic language networks, in which he engaged proponents of extremist views, such as the claim that a Muslim cannot owe allegiance to a state ruled by non-Muslims, summoning for his arguments quotations from the Quran, from the collections of sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, and other traditional sources.
Now, he had returned to Iraq earlier this month, and presumably, what was he doing there?
His purpose in going to Najaf reportedly was to spare both the holy sites and the population from the damage wreaked by war. He reached Najaf from Jordan and was reportedly under American protection, although this is disputed. Whether fact or rumor, this might have contributed actually to the anger that led to his death.
As you, I'm sure you've seen reports, and there are different ones emerging about what actually happened inside that mosque today. But according to one report that I read, he apparently came in accompanying the man who had been in charge during the last years of Saddam Hussein.
It is actually that there are lots of conflicting reports. Indeed, it's the case. It's reported that he had intended to call on Shia Muslims to support the American British forces. Actually, more likely, his call would have been one for reconciliation, and that would explain the company of that man. And he would have probably called to cooperate with the American and British forces for the establishment of law and order in the south of Iraq. He is, whether in his intellectual or more recently in his political positions, a man of reconciliation.
And what do we know of, if anything, if there's anything we do know for sure, about the people who killed him?
I think it's too early to speculate about who is behind the killing. The situation is indeed extremely tense in Najaf and elsewhere. And in such instances, unfortunate, unintended events can take place. So it's important not to read too much into it. Can it be a reflection of interclerical rivalries or of tension between long-term residents and returning exiles, or maybe even some agitation caused by remnants of forces loyal to the regime? This is all speculation. What is known is that Iraq, and indeed the whole Muslim world, has lost the voice of moderation and reason in this assassination.
Obviously, he went back to Iraq after a long time outside the country. Had he maintained contacts with the religious community inside Iraq?
To the extent that that was feasible, yes, indeed. Meaning that there is, on a permanent basis, meaning in terms of the clerical network, that there are communications and there are people who go back and forth. But, I mean, the level of communication clearly was discreet.
Most Americans, as I'm sure you know, are widely ignorant of the divisions and differences between various sects of Islam. Most of us can barely keep it straight of what's the division between Shia and Sunni. But if you could, for a moment, tell us a little bit about the different factions inside the Shia community and who are, if there are known representatives of each one.
Actually, it's not accurate to refer to them as factions. What you have, you do not have a strict hierarchy in the, let's say, the Catholic Church sense of the term. What you have is you have prominent leaders who basically emerge and become sources, what is referred to as marja, meaning sources of imitation, that they have followers. And basically, you can get to the point of having one such marja to become very prominent and basically all the respect of the worldwide community. And this was the case of Abdul Masjid's father, Abul Qasim. Another Ayatollah who's currently in Najaf and we had heard about is Ayatollah Sistani, who had originally issued an edict, that is a fatwa, forbidding his followers to cooperate with the advancing American and British forces. He later relaxed his commandment to not opposing them. But, I mean, indeed, the Western press and the American press in particular seems to miss the nuances of these religious edicts, and therefore his second fatwa, the one of not opposing the American and British forces, was read as being an endorsement of their presence. I mean, it is important to note that you would have basically clerics and supporters who are very loyal to them, but it is not accurate to think of them in terms of as a sectarian division. It's more a question of allegiance to a person.
So personality rather than title would dominate these different groups.
Indeed.
Okay. And finally, the meeting, the reconciliation meeting, was occurring at the mosque, we understand. These were Iraqis called in to discuss the future of control of this vital and important institution. Were any representatives of the U.S. forces who are in the area, were any of them there?
Not to my knowledge. I would be surprised if they were indeed there.
And the fact, if in fact they were not there, and again, we're not sure, but if they were not there, does that tell you something important?
I would avoid trying to read too much into it, because as I mentioned, it might have been a situation that basically degenerated, or it might be something that is planned. It is too early to tell.
Hassan Nehmeh, thanks very much, and we'll obviously keep up with this important story and try to learn more.
Thank you.
Hassan Nehmeh, director of the Iraq Research and Documentation Project at Harvard University, and he joined us on the phone from his office there. We're going to continue bringing you the latest, and when we come back from a short break, we're going to discuss more on the history of the capital of Iraq, Baghdad. A little later, the emotional reaction to an emotional day. We'll speak with an Iraqi-American, a Saudi journalist, and an American peace activist about their reactions to the fall of Baghdad, plus your calls on that same question. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, TOTN, at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For 3 weeks and a day now, the world has been riveted to breaking news from Baghdad, from the first wave of bombing sending up plumes of fire on the skyline to triumphant crowds massing in the streets yesterday. But we're going to take a step back now. way back and look at another moment when Baghdad stood at the center of the world stage. Joining us to illuminate a bit of the city's storied history is Richard Bullitt, professor of Middle East history at Columbia University in New York. And professor, good of you to join us tonight.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the founding of the city.
It founded in the 750s. There was a dynasty that took over at that time and a revolutionary movement called the Abbasid dynasty. They decided to build a new city as their capital, and they picked on this location, which was on the outskirts of an older capital city from the pre-Islamic period. It was a city that they designed as a circular walled city with a large central area in which you only had the mosque and the palace, and then the army was pretty much situated in the other parts of the round city. And then you had popular quarters on the outside of the round city that were composed of the indigenous population of the area. But it was built in the 750s and lasted as a great center for about 250 years.
Well, as you mentioned, Baghdad was built as a capital and almost immediately leapt to prominence on the world stage, such as there was in the 7th century A.D. What was life like in the round city?
The round city has disappeared. We have architectural conjectures as to what it looked like, but it was primarily a military garrison, and the culture that developed was much more a culture in the popular quarters in the outlying areas and in the palaces that were built outside the round city. So what it was like initially is a little hard to tell. It was probably basically a military garrison, but within 50 years, it had become a center of a glittering court culture with vast sums of money available to the caliphs and their viziers to hand out to poets and scientists and scholars and legal figures. And it had become a very, very lively commercial center. It was a city that was extremely cosmopolitan because the caliphate was so large, and it drew in people from India, from Africa, from all parts of the Middle East, and even from farther afield. So it was a great world capital.
Was it a great center of learning?
It was a center of learning, but it was a learning that that took place more by individual scholars than by universities. You don't have the institution of Islamic colleges arising until perhaps 200 years later. But the learning that took place was very much under the patronage of the caliph's court, and it focused very heavily on translation of works of philosophy and science and literature from Greek and Middle Persian and Sanskrit, so that you had a huge flood of knowledge coming into the world of Arabic speakers during the early period of the Abbasid Caliphate.
Now, much of the West's imagination of this great city of Baghdad in their golden age, I guess, goes back to the great bedtime story, the Thousand and One Nights. Now, how much of that, we don't expect our fairy tales to live up to, exacting reality, but how much of that was accurate?
Well, the stories themselves come from many sources. Many of them are pre-Islamic stories. The part of it that seems to reflect some sort of reality of the 8th and 9th centuries deals with the prominence of the family of viziers who administered the empire on behalf of the caliph Harun al-Rashid, and this was the Barmakid family.
Now, Harun al-Rashid is the guy who figures in a lot of these tales, the 1001 Nights.
He does, but in some respects the Barmakids figure even more strongly, but this is the era that it's placed in, right around 800 A.D. And as far as things like genies in bottles, that obviously is fantasy. As far as the notion of bands of thieves, that was probably a reality. But we don't see in the 1001 Nights the sort of a scholarly court culture that actually existed, and it's not a very reliable place to go to find out about Baghdad.
And that next you're going to tell me Hollywood's not a good way to find out about American culture. Now, what became of Baghdad? There was you mentioned it. This golden age lasted, what, 250 years?
It lasted about 250 years, and then the city started into a substantial decline with declining revenues, declining political power, and gradually it became very ramshackle. There was ultimately the sort of deterioration of the city culminated in the destruction of the city by a Mongol invader in 1258, and indeed I'm sure that historians will compare the fall of Baghdad this week to the fall of Baghdad to the Mongols in 1258. In both cases, you have foreign armies that come in and destroy the ruler of the city. The difference, of course, is that the Mongols inflicted incredible physical destruction, as well as changing the regime of that time, whereas the physical plan of Baghdad will survive our conquest much better. But the irony, of course, is that there are no ancient buildings in Baghdad to speak of. Nothing remains of the Round City. Nothing remains of the great days of Harun al-Rashid or the other early caliphs. And, in fact, the only buildings that really go back to the pre-Mongol period are just two or three, and they're from fairly late in that era.
Richard Bullitt, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Richard Bullitt, a professor of Middle Eastern history at Columbia University, and he was with us from his office in New York. Many people woke up yesterday morning to the news that Saddam Hussein's regime had collapsed in Baghdad. All day we heard reports of looting, street fighting, and celebration, and also the apparent melting away of Saddam's intelligence apparatus and his military. For the rest of this hour, we want to hear your reaction to the news. Were you surprised, impressed, relieved, or, like many Iraqis, of mixed feelings? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN, at NPR.org. First, though, here's how our own Anne Garrels described the scenes in Baghdad once it became clear that the Hussein regime was gone.
And then the night was quiet. There wasn't a lot of bombing, a lot of fighting. And so I think something just snapped. And then when the first looters went out and nothing happened, and then more looters went out, and then the troops came right into the center of the city, it just one thing piled onto the other. And it was only late today, really just at dusk, that women and children came out. You know, they didn't get the confidence to come out until much later.
Joining us now is Imam Sayed Muftafa Al-Kazwini, an Iraqi-American imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County in California. We've been checking in with him periodically over the past several weeks now, and he's with us now from his home in Pomona. Good to speak with you again.
Glad to be with you, Neil.
So what did you think as you watched the images of the citizens of Baghdad bringing down that statue of Saddam yesterday?
Well, we were overwhelmed with joy and happiness. This is what we have been dreaming for the last 3 decades, and now it's a reality. It really brought happiness, jubilation to the heart of the Iraqis inside and outside Iraq. But on the other hand, this happiness was not really completed, because we also saw images of anarchy, lawlessness, chaos, looting and theft and rioting all over Baghdad and other cities in Basra. Now there are reports of the same things happening in Kirkuk. So, it wasn't a pure celebration yesterday.
No, hardly that. What are you hearing? You mentioned your community. Were people in the Iraqi-American community, at least where you live, watching this together or calling back and forth, or what was going on?
Well, most of the families are, many people did not go to work yesterday. They were sitting in front of TVs watching Al Jazeera, CNN, other TV stations reporting what's happening in Baghdad and other cities. Also, we received some sad news. Only a few hours today, we lost... I myself lost a relative and a very, very close friend in the city of Najaf a son of a Shia leader. His name is Sayyid Abdul Majid al-Khoi, who was assassinated in the shrine of Imam Ali in the center of the city of Najaf. And it is a big loss to me personally, to the Iraqi community, in particular to the Shia Muslims worldwide.
Our condolences for his death. I did not know that he was a relative of yours.
Thank you, Neil.
He had just returned to Iraq a few weeks ago, and we know that you had spoken, and many people in your community are thinking about going back to Iraq to help rebuild. Does this change your thinking at all?
I think everything now is on hold. In fact, I was planning to leave today, Thursday, and to join other people there. When I spoke with Abdul Majid al-Khoi 3 days ago, he assured me about the security, safety and security in both Najaf and Karbala. But today it appeared that there was this incident. We don't know the details of this incident. We don't know whether those are the remaining personnel of Saddam supporters or other forces there. But I know many people who decided in the past to leave. They are putting things on hold. They are giving it a second thought. We ask the coalition forces to provide safety and security for the Iraqi citizens.
Yes, but this incident apparently happened inside the famous mosque in Najaf. Surely you don't want coalition forces in there.
Of course, but they can protect the place from outside. They can put checkpoints. They can restore law and order, of course, with the cooperation of religious leaders, tribal leaders in these two cities. I think there is some room to do a lot of things there if they are willing to do so. Again, we received some reports that some of the lootings were happening right in the front of their eyes, and they did not do anything to prevent that. And this is really a big cause for concern for all of us.
We're going to take your calls on your reactions to the news of the fall of Baghdad. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's begin with Tamara, who's with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, well, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I noticed a couple things regarding the famous footage that we've been seeing of the statue in Baghdad falling down. One of the things I was wondering why is we just keep on seeing that same 15 seconds of footage over and over and over and over again, and all of a sudden I find out that there, you know, I was expecting to see crowd shots a la, you know, the Berlin Wall falling of thousands upon thousands of Iraqis cheering, you know, the statue coming down. But then there was a shot of a distant shot of the plaza where the statue was, and if you took out the soldiers and the journalists and discounted the about half a dozen tanks around the area, there were maybe 100-odd Iraqis.
200 was the estimate that a reporter told us yesterday.
And it wasn't, yeah, and when I compared that to the number of people filling the hospitals, you know, the dead and the wounded from the missile attacks, you know, the ones whose faces we're not seeing on TV right now, at least not in America, you know, and you know, people shouldn't be awfully surprised that we're having things like suicide bombings like we just had in Baghdad, because, you know, people aren't greeting us with flowers and candy, not unless it's for a photo op like we just saw yesterday. So,
well, Tamara, thanks very much. Appreciate your phone call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Imam, I wanted to ask you, what was your reaction? Obviously, that was not a huge crowd that tore down the statue in Firdaus Square in downtown Baghdad. But was this a thin response, do you think?
Well, I think this happened in the early hours of taking control of the city by the American forces. And not many Iraqis were free to move around the city at that time. Many of them were afraid to leave their homes. Many of them were, they did not know what the reaction of the American forces would be once they occupy these important places in the city. But, of course, it emerged later that it was a very peaceful takeover. And then we saw, at the end of the day, a big number of people coming out of their homes. And remember, that particular area was not purely a residential area. It was an area where the important hotels were there, and there were journalists there. So we could not see a lot of people around that statue.
Okay. Let's go now to James, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Neil, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment. Your question was, how did you feel when you saw the statue fall? And my initial reaction and immediate reaction was, gosh, let's not lose the momentum now that we're actually doing something and people are applauding us in that part of the country. Let's, or that part of the world. Let's, you know, let's do something else. Let's quit talking about things and capitalizing on the momentum that we have in the Middle East right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Imam al-Qazwini, that would certainly be an important thing for all of the people in Iraq who are waiting to see what happens and what the U.S. and Britain do.
Yes, my feeling at that moment was that the entire dictatorship in Iraq is being collapsed at that moment, and this would not be only confined to this capital and to this city. We were hoping to see similar scenes soon in some other countries which is being governed by despotism and dictatorship.
Well, James, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And I wanted to, before we say goodbye, I wanted to read this email we got from Bart Ford in Norman, Oklahoma. As someone who's been against this war from the very beginning, I feel a bit of relief from the images of jubilant Iraqi citizens. I would like nothing more than to be proven wrong about the whole thing and have a stable democratic government in a free Iraq. However, he adds, I'm still skeptical. And Imam, I'm sure all of us share his hopes, and I guess all of us have some degree of that fear as well.
That's right. But we as Iraqis, we should never forget to be grateful to God first for this gift, and also to the American government, the British government, despite all the pressures on the president here by the United Nations, by some European countries, by the international community, the Arab, the Muslim countries. He succeeded in accomplishing his mission and achieving his goals by toppling this regime. Of course, we have concerns about the security of the ordinary people. I personally have concerns about the territorial integrity of Iraq, but I hope that the coalition forces, as they succeeded in bringing Saddam Hussein down, they will succeed in bringing stability and peace to Iraq.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Neil.
And we'll be in touch.
Yes, thank you.
Imam Syed Mustafa al-Qazwini, Imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County in California. He joined us from his home in Pomona. After a break, we'll take more of your calls about the collapse of the Hussein regime and speak with a peace activist and with a Saudi journalist about their reactions. 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on the next Science Friday for a look at the crisis facing apes in West Africa, plus updates on SARS and the Columbia shuttle investigation. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about reaction to the collapse of Saddam's regime in Baghdad. Just a few moments ago, we spoke with an Iraqi imam living in California. We want to hear your reaction. 800-989-8255 or send us email, totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Peggy Gish, a 60-year-old organic vegetable farmer and peace activist from Athens, Ohio. She was in Baghdad when the bombing started and was one of a small group of peace activists who camped out in tents at the Al-Wathba Water Treatment Plant in northern Baghdad after the bombing began. She's with us now from her home in Athens, Ohio, where she returned a week ago. Welcome.
Thank you.
What did you? What was your reaction when you saw the news yesterday?
Well, I felt a lot of grief. I didn't feel any celebration because I put that in the context of the whole war. I felt grief at the destruction and loss of life that I saw in the 10 days of bombing that I was in Baghdad. And the costs are just too great to see that as a victory. And I expect that there's going to be a lot more suffering to come. I don't think that it is over.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there talking with the Iraqi people, the majority of people that I talked to did not see this as a war of liberation. One 18-year-old young man that we talked to said, "This is not liberation. This is aggression. If this is democracy, we don't want it."
Yet
even those who did not like their government, who did not like Saddam Hussein, did not want another country coming in and taking over.
Yet, undeniably, there were plenty of people in Baghdad yesterday that did hand flowers to American Marines as they came into the city and did embrace them.
Yeah, I expect that there are those that are happy. I think they're a small minority of people.
Mm-hmm. What was it like to be camped at that water processing plant during the bombing?
Well, we did it as a symbolic gesture of being vulnerable with the Iraqi people in the time of bombing. It was frightening, which I expect it was similar to what the Iraqi people were feeling at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'd been in Baghdad, what, for several months before
the
bombing?
Yeah, 5 months.
Why did you go?
I went, first of all, as a Christian, I've been told to love my enemies, and I wanted to meet those people who were called my enemies. And I came to find out for myself what was really happening there, what the Iraqi people were really like, and to find out what the conditions of life are. And so while we were there, we lived among the Iraqi people. We walked the streets, and we were able to freely talk to people without any kind of monitoring. So I heard from people from all kinds of backgrounds and points of view. You know, they're not all of one mind, just like we are here, mm-hmm. You know, of diverse. And I reported back through articles and letters and stories that I sent back home. We talked with many of the United Nations agencies, gathering factual information about, you know, the results of the 12 and a half years of sanctions and what, you know, the destruction of the society that had caused.
Mm-hmm.
And we were also there because we wanted to do everything we could to try to prevent a war.
Did the Iraqi government ask you to stay at that water plant?
No, they did not. And in that way, we were not human shields. We had a freedom of choice where we went. We chose to go there. That was a place where we had planted a symbolic tree of life earlier, and we had met the workers. We had been working in a hospital adjoining that plant just next door, a children's hospital. We were going there in the mornings with arts and crafts for the children in the cancer ward. And so we felt like we were there accompanying a whole neighborhood. And we were, you know, walking the streets. Even in the first days of the bombing, we were walking the streets, meeting people, you know, and the families.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get some more listeners involved.
Okay.
Jacques joins us now from Gilbert, Arizona.
Yes. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
What I wanted to say is exactly what's going on in Iraq, that's been going on in Iraq since yesterday, is exactly what happened in Haiti on February 7, 1986. After Jean-Claude Duvalier left the country, the looting was happening the exact same way. And what they basically had to do is they had a curfew. I think it was probably right around 12 o'clock in the afternoon. They had a curfew. That's the only thing that did stop everything. Mm. And what's going on in Iraq is no different. I do not know how it has happened elsewhere, but it's no different than what happened in Haiti.
Were you there?
Yes, I was in Haiti when it happened.
Mm.
The next step, which is the scary step, some people are going to lose their lives because payback going to happen. And that's where it's going to be dangerous for the coalition force, because they're going to have to step up and prevent things like that from happening. And I think if they want to prevent looting, they're going to have to incorporate curfew. And I do not know how well it's going to happen, but that's the way it has happened. And I think it's a great thing for the Iraqi people. And I don't want anybody to think anything else but then what the goal is. Freedom for the Iraqi people, and sometimes it can happen within the country. In case of Haiti, that's the way it happened. In Iraq, the coalition force had to do it, but do not think it's about oil. Do not think it's about anti-Muslim, anti-Islam. It's strictly against Saddam and the Saddam Hussein regime. The sooner people can put that in their mind, the better off it will be for all the parties involved to move forward and reconstruct Iraq. Because those people have been hurt for so long, and I think now they deserve all the chance they can have. And it's about time for everybody to put their head together and say, what can we do to rebuild Iraq? What's best for the Iraqi people?
Well, thanks, Jock, very much. Appreciate it.
All right.
Peggy Gish, I wonder, there's a lot in there, but among the other things, I wonder if you're thinking, obviously you met a lot of people in Iraq and you must be very worried about them.
I am.
And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about going back.
I do have thoughts about going back. I would like to go back there during a time of peace and when they're not under threat, but it's possible I would go back if this is a kind of a long ordeal, the possibly going back and just being a nonviolent presence in that situation is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'd also want to share was that during the time of the bombing, we weren't just at the plant, but we were also visiting hospitals, you know, where civilians who had been injured were being brought in. And also we went out to various sites, civilian sites that had been bombed. And one of the most troubling things for me was to see in the walls of the home, one of the homes we visited that had been bombed, right next to a school that was damaged, was the little uniform metal pellets from a cluster bomb. And then to go to the hospital and talk to the doctor who showed us X-rays of a particular young girl who was just had hundreds of these pellets all through her body, you know, and to know it was hard to see that my country would again drop cluster anti-personnel bombs on the people.
You were eventually kicked out of Iraq.
I was, yeah.
Can you tell us briefly why?
Sure. It was Friday morning, March 28th. We heard a loud explosion, and our hotel rocked. And we heard that a telephone communications building four blocks from our hotel was bombed. And so we were needing to go over to another hotel for our team meeting, and no transportation showed up. And we had been told not to walk around just without escort. And this was like the ninth day of the bombing. And so we were walking over there and decided that we would just turn the corner and see that site. And we got up to about a half a block from the telephone building that had been damaged. We saw a lot of damage around it, too, from other buildings. But then police showed up. We were detained because they thought that we had taken pictures of the site, and they considered that a security risk in case we would somehow let, you know, U.S. military know what we saw as far as the results of the bombing. But anyway, we were told that we were being asked to leave because we had walked over there without a government escort, without our minder. The Iraqi, you know, officials were very uptight with having U.S. people there, and they didn't want us walking the streets freely as we had done earlier in our time there.
Well, Peggy Gish, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Peggy Gish, a peace activist who joined us from her home in Athens, Ohio. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Khalid Al-Mayina. He's editor-in-chief of Arab News, an English language daily for the Middle East. And he joins us from his office in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Good of you to be back with us on Talk of the Nation.
Good to hear from my side. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How did you react when you saw Iraqis yesterday celebrating in the streets of Baghdad?
Well, I think it was a sense of relief. I felt happy in many ways, not only because they were, you know, celebrating, but also that the bombings had stopped, because the people who were suffering in the last 20 days were not Saddam and his cronies who were somewhere, but the poor people who were being hit, and the poor children and the people around. So I think that was a sense of relief for me. Also, I felt happy that this tyrant and dictator had finally gone away, or at least disappeared from the scene for the moment.
I'm interested in what you just said, and I'm sure there's no question about the fact that civilians have been injured and killed in the fighting in and around Baghdad. But you really think that Saddam and his Republican Guards and the Special Republican Guards were not the target of U.S. military operations? It was the people?
Well, it's not I don't think that there was a deliberate bombing. But the point is that in order to get rid of one man, hundreds of other people, if not thousands, were being sort of hit. There's no such thing as collateral damage, precise bombing. I mean, the marketplace and other areas. And we who were closer here could see through several TV stations, European, non-European, and Asian, the impacts on the lives of these people. So I think that was of concern to me. I do not like to see blood being shed, any blood. And that sort of upset me a lot and upset many people in this part of the world.
We're talking to listeners as well, and we're asking them to join us, and I'm going to bring up one now. David joins us on the line from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Hi. Good afternoon, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I guess I have some mixed emotions about what is happening over there. I am very excited and very happy for the Iraqi people that this is happening, because I think that it holds a lot of a lot of potential for the country. But at the same time, just as you know, like maybe when you give a child too many responsibilities, that sometimes they are not able or capable of dealing with those responsibilities appropriately. And I just, I'm just concerned for what lies ahead in Iraq.
Well, Khalid Al-Mayina, do you think that mixed reactions is a fair way to describe the reactions of Saudis as well?
Well, yes, many had that mixed reaction, but I don't think so the Iraqis are that immature. Remember, this is the cradle of civilization. Remember also that these people had a parliament, they had a government going on until it was hijacked by these people in uniform. And I think given the right type of atmosphere and the right type of help from the United States and from other friendly countries, and getting the right leaders who command the respect of the Iraqi people, I think the Iraqis can make a go for it.
David, thanks very much.
Yes, thank you.
Here's an email we got from Patty in Cheyenne, Wyoming. What hit home the most was a story relayed from a journalist about an Iraqi who approached a Marine telling him he wanted to start exercising his free speech. He told the Marine he didn't want him there long. To that, the Marine replied, "Me neither." And Khalid Al-Mayina, I think we can all echo that.
Well, yes, I think the Iraqis, but I don't think so the Iraqis should say that, because a lot of the infrastructure is destroyed. I think they need a lot of rehab programs that will get the country on its feet. And having said that, I think the Iraqis are not short of qualified people. Remember that 4 to 5 million people are living abroad. And once these people come in, and there are organizations and NGOs and help from the United Nations and other aid agencies, these people can make a life. Also remember that these people are not poor people. There is oil, and there are other resources.
Khalid Al-Mayina, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.